This is Fresh Air. My guest, Gail Pemberton, is the Associate Director of Afro-American Studies at Princeton University. It's one of several universities she's taught at, and she's usually been one of few blacks on the faculty. Racial consciousness is part of her family tradition. Her father worked for the Urban League, her grandfather was one of the few black architects of his time, and he owned an autographed copy of W.E.B. Du Bois' book, The Souls of Black Folk. Family, race, and American culture are the subjects of Gail Pemberton's new memoir, The Hottest Water in Chicago. Her first chapter is about her father, who died in 1977, shortly after retiring. She describes him as a race man.
It's an old expression in the black community, and that is that it's someone who worked in race relations. My father worked for the Urban League, so anybody who was in the NAACP or the Urban League or had an active role in trying to, and even if they weren't in those organizations, but their main effort was on behalf of the race, lawyers, for example, they were called race men. And so that's what my father was.
Describe what your father's job was.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about this a couple of days ago because it was not the sort of thing where in this 50 scenario, Daddy would come home and I would say, "Gee, Dad, what did you do?" I mean, one of those romanticized notions. My idea of what my father did was in one of his jobs, and he was before he became an executive, before he became really the head of one of the Urban League branches, he was the secondary man who was called in that time industrial relations. So really, he was kind of a broker for hiring blacks. There was not an easy entrance into some industries. Unions were, for the most part, segregated. How did you take qualified high school graduates, get them into certain sorts of jobs? So that the Urban League work that my father did then was, and this is what he was doing in Chicago in the early days, trying to really find and place blacks in businesses. As his responsibilities grew and he became more successful, it was then negotiating at a higher level, talking to unions, developing a plan whereby the labor force could become more diverse. So it was really always hands-on, and it had to do with equal opportunity.
Sometimes your father was called on to integrate a place himself, to be, what, the first black person to enter the place. And that was the case in a story that you tell in your memoir about the time he was called on to integrate a transient flea bag hotel. What were the circumstances behind this? Why did the proprietor of the hotel want the hotel integrated?
We never knew. It's one of the mysteries. And so when I say in the book that my scenario, I suspect my father would approve, because he never discovered the intention behind it either, is that I made the assumption, this was some license, that the owner of the hotel, aware of what was the beginning of quite a bit of social ferment with Brown versus the Board of Education, with the end of sort of the Korean War, and the fact that Truman had integrated the armed services. There were a number of things, and we're on the verge of the most public parts of the civil rights movement. I mean, this is a year before the Montgomery bus boycott, but there are things in the air. There have been things in the air since the March on Washington movement around World War II and even before that. But there are things happening. And I just suspect that this man got what he would call, and perhaps we all would call, a pang of conscience, and decided to do it.
I'm going to ask you to pick up the story by reading a passage from your book. And this is a passage where your father's gone to the hotel, and the proprietor is showing him around.
"Let me show you the room," Sam says to my father. They walk to a single door that opens onto a gated elevator. Smells of urine and alcohol permeate the small space. My father sighs. Sam takes my father to the third floor. As they get out of the elevator, they are met by a single dull exit sign pointing to a stairwell to the left. There are three equally spaced bare light bulbs hanging from the ceiling. On either side of the long corridor are cubicles partitioned with chicken wire, each cubicle with a dirty mattress and a rickety nightstand. On each nightstand are aluminum ashtrays, two Dixie cups, a hand towel, and a hotel-sized bar of soap, unwrapped. My father coughs slightly, the smell of extermination catching the smoky mucus at the base of his throat. "I see," he says. "Every new guest is provided a clean, newly sprayed room," Sam explains. There is an uncomfortable pause as a ragged man passes on his way to the bathroom. The man mutters something inaudible, hawks, prepares to spit, and then suppresses it. Sam says quickly, "You need anything, you come get me at the desk. Anybody bother you, you let me know. This is a friendly establishment. And, for your information, we have the hottest water in Chicago." My father said Sam beamed and rose on his toes with that line. End of story.
What a great story. A really strange part of your father's work that
yes,
day, I'm sure.
Yes.
My guest is Gail Pemberton, Associate Director of Afro-American Studies at Princeton University and author of the new memoir, The Hottest Water in Chicago. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Gail Pemberton is my guest, and we're discussing her new memoir and her life. Now, you are middle class. Your family is largely from the professional class. And I'm wondering if white people and black people have ever made certain assumptions about you, who didn't realize that you were born into a couple of generations of the middle class.
Oh, sure. I mean, this is the problem with racism. You look at someone and you decide that they fit something that's in your head. And so that then you seek for them, you look for all the signs that they're conforming to what is increasingly a narrower and narrower and narrower stereotype. It's like when people expect a certain quality or accent or something to come out of your mouth. And the visual expressions that I get from people who are expecting some kind of accent or who are expecting a particular kind of vocabulary that I don't know whether or not it exists, but it exists somewhere in their heads, and they're listening for it to come out.
A couple of times you've been mistaken for other people. You write about someone who met you at a faculty party, I think it was, and said, "Oh, you must be Toni Morrison."
Right.
And somebody else in a doctor's office said, "Oh, would you be Maya yes. Angelou?" Do you think that that comes out of seeing you as someone who looks kind of like an intellectual, like there might be somebody kind of important and well-known, and they think, oh, I know somebody important and well-known, Toni Morrison. You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a fact that that people don't look for individuation in a group.
Yeah.
There's not that sensitivity. It's I've heard people say these things about Asian people. Oh, I can't tell these people apart. You're not looking. But all right, there can't be very many intellectual-sounding black people. And let's see, where are we? We're at a writers' conference. All right, let's see, how many black writers are there who are women? Okay, I've narrowed it down. You have to be. You know, so it's a burden, again, of the terrible state of race in our country.
You've taught at several universities, including some Ivy League schools. And I'm wondering if you ever feel that you were kind of continuing your father's work in integrating institutions?
Yes, yes. I have, on several occasions, been the only black person, sometimes the only black woman on a faculty. And someone asked me a couple of years ago, well, why aren't you an activist? I said, well, I don't know what you mean by that. I'm not constitutionally an activist. I'm an academic, and I think I'm a writer now. But I have been doing my father's work ever since I left home, and that is race relations. And so it is continuing, and continuing in a place that I think is very important. I've taught in some very fine schools and felt that my presence was extremely important for the black students there and as important for the non-black students there as well.
What are some of the things that you face when you are the only African-American woman or the only African-American at all on the faculty of a university?
Well, first of all, there's the given assumption that somehow you're not any good. I mean, that you've been hired for reasons other than excellence. And this is just one of those givens in the culture, and if you spend any time thinking about it, you can go berserk. The places where I've taught had a tendency not to hire people who were unqualified. I mean, that's not the way you maintain your excellence, so let's stop that. But there's a kind of romanticizing that I am assumed by some students to be necessarily cool. So I remember arriving on one campus where the requirement was of all seniors to write a thesis. And I got there and I was just visiting for a year. The first day in my office, five students came by and said, "You're our thesis advisor." I said, "Wait, I just got here." I said, "No, you're it." I said, "But does everyone have five students for theses?" "Well, no. Not everyone does, and some people don't have any, but you're our thesis advisor. And these women wanted to write on Toni Morrison and Alice Walker, and then one wanted to write on Emily Dickinson. But it was the sense that because I'm Black and because I'm a woman, I'm going to be open to, sympathetic to certain sorts of things. And this has been disastrous in many careers where people are, where students and colleagues suddenly assume that you are a that you can hear their confessions and that you're a parental surrogate because you don't look like their parents, but you're older. So you get told things that you say, I don't want to hear this. Why are people telling me these things? Is that you're fulfilling some role, some idea and it's not always good. And there are many people who have not managed to get tenure because they have been pulled so many ways, asked to be on every committee, asked to be the spokesman for this and that. And in the meantime, what they're there to do, which is teaching and scholarship, loses.
So how did you react to all these requests?
I had five thesis students. They were, you know, five really interesting young women, and I couldn't say, oh, well, forget it.
When you were about 18, I think it was, you spent a year studying in England. And you write that when you were in England, you realized that one of racism's aims was to keep Black people intellectually and emotionally provincial, to keep them in a mental ghetto as well as an environmental one.
Yes.
How did you have that realization?
I had the realization because in the interactions that I had with several people in Britain, the assumption was that I had developed an opinion and that I had character and that they were interested in the manifestation of that, that they had cut through with their question, with their glance, the veil that exists in our country. Now, this was not to say that I think Britain is like that. I'm saying that at that moment, at that age, people were expecting me to have had a sense of all sorts of issues that were going on in the United States. There was Vietnam. There were any number of other things. And I realized that I hadn't been encouraged to think about those things at all, that I had been encouraged to think only about American policies as they attended race, as that my whole life was intellectual life had to be involved with issues of race. That's a ghettoizing, because clearly I needed to be able to understand, even at 17 years old, the relationship that race, let us say, had with Vietnam, but also a geopolitical recognition of how things worked that I just didn't have and didn't really, and as I put it, have the citizenship. My citizenship was weak, and I felt that second-class citizenship is also not being expected to hold your end up and to have opinions about things that perhaps do not affect your own life intimately as race does.
So how did that realization change your thinking?
Well, it allowed me to take a breath out and, let's say, take 1 inch of my antenna down and to relax just a little bit, not a whole lot, and to take in this new and foreign environment and interact with it in a way that had me develop new skills, as it were. I couldn't make assumptions in looking at a white person or hearing something that this language was coded. I mean, coded language has been going on for a long time. And so I could tell, growing up in the Middle West, all sorts of things by the glances and comments from white people. That was completely thrown off kilter. I was meeting Britons, I was meeting other Europeans, and so I couldn't make those assumptions. And they couldn't make those assumptions about me. And so there was a way in which we were having a quality of interaction and discourse that I had never had before then, and I'm sorry to say I haven't had since.
The year that you were in England, that you had this realization about intellectual ghettos, was the same year of the riots in Watts.
Yes.
So I'm going to just ask you what you've made of the recent riots in Los Angeles and other cities, and what kind of feelings that brought out in you.
It was the dull ache in the stomach that I remember having when I heard of Watts. What I feel now about it all is that in the earlier riots in Watts, there was more understanding of the problem, and there was a greater sense of how people had to hang together to solve it. What makes me very nervous about the current revolt is that I think white America understands less about the causes and the enduring agony of the extraordinary depth of racism that has, I think, not at all been discouraged in the years since. And in reading the newspaper this morning and seeing that gun sales have gone up 20% in California and other places, it seems to me that the bottom line is that the way in which we perceive in solving these problems is through violence. And so I am gloomier now than I was as I was walking around that ship going abroad, and I was as gloomy as I had ever been that day. So it's a matter of, I think, an extraordinary sense of will and love of country that people are going to have to resist kinds of rhetoric and say, what's the problem? This is the problem. This is how we solve it, and everybody is a part of it.
Gail Pemberton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Gail Pemberton's new memoir, The Hottest Water in Chicago, is published by Faber and Faber. This is Fresh Air.